sometimes you gotta think like a lady.
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 And act like a boss.
Welcome to Think Like a Lady. You can follow us on Twitter at @ThinkLikeALady_ or on Facebook at @ThinkLikeALadyPodcast, as well as on Instagram at @ThinkLikeALady_podcast. We're available to listen to on all the major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or just ask Amazon Alexa.
Welcome back to Think Like a Lady. This is Afroz.
And this is Dua.
Last week, we talked about Muslim unity. This week, we let you guys pick the topic.
We want to start off by thanking everyone who sent us comments and, you know, let us know what it was that they were interested in hearing on our podcast. And it's so great to know that there are people who, you know, are, I don't know, listening to us regularly.
I mean, it's so great to know that there's so many people engaged. You guys also entered in a chance to win $100, so we'll be announcing that by the end of the week.
Courtesy of Afroz.
But, yeah, so one that really struck our eye was from a user named MF Hussein with 3 N's. He or she, I don't know, commented the unhealthy dynamics between some parents and their kids. I feel like sometimes some parents take advantage of the rights they have over their children in Islam. Sometimes we get comments here and there, and I get feedback here and there, where a lot of the times people are under the impression as if we're preachers of some kind, and we're not.
I'm not a preacher.
I'm not a preacher, and I'm definitely not the preachy kind. What we often do is we meld, you know.
I think what we do is we do a combination of, like, what we know Islamically, right? And we never take information from nothing. You know, what the information that we take when we're referring to something from a religious perspective is directly from the Quran or the Hadith. And then on top of that, we kind of overlay our own experiences and things that we've been through in our own life, or, you know, maybe even things that, you know, for you, I know you integrate a lot of stuff from your work, you know, you're very much so pulling statistics and things like that. So we kind of take things from everywhere.
We try to make a thorough analysis of how it's applicable in real life. You know, how does Islam manifest itself in our everyday lives?
Right.
So rather, you know, and we've always made this a very distinct point, is that we're never going to tell people what to do. We have our words of wisdom, which is very, very usually, like, you know, from woman to woman. But it's never from a position of being a preacher.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's more so a thorough analysis. And often when people use Islam, and I wield that logic against it, because I feel oftentimes it's coming from a place of culture and indoctrination, and often at odds with reality.
Well, and not only that, but isn't that the point too, is like to help people understand that there is a major difference between culture and religion, right? And understanding that those are not one and the same. Those are two completely different things, because a lot of cultures actually don't even coincide with the religious teachings, right? And not only that, but what we do is just a conversation, right? Because there are plenty of times where we actually disagree with each other.
Right, openly. So,
yeah. And so, you know, this isn't to, you know, be getting people to think like, oh, we have the answers, we have all of the answers, and we're telling you what the right answer is. No, it's a conversation to discuss, you know, both sides of the viewpoints and things like that, based on the information and the knowledge and the experiences that we have.
Exactly. So, I mean, we received a few comments here and there, and then where it was just like...
But this was the hijab one. Yeah, exactly.
They were like, why would you preach about women to take off hijab? And I'm like, we're not preaching about women to take off hijab. We're explaining to you why women do it.
Well, and not, there was another one, right? We talked about, like, I think it was... I can't remember the name of the episode, but it was talking about sex outside of marriage and just kind of sex in general.
Like, astaghfirullah, how dare you talk?
No, there were people who were saying, like, you guys are encouraging zina. And it's like, no, we're not encouraging zina. We're just telling you that, you know, if somebody engages in these things, it's not the end of the world for them, you know? Like, we're kind of coming at it from a more holistic point of view, where it's, you know, Islam teaches kindness, and Islam teaches forgiveness. I mean, that's the biggest thing about Islam is Allah said, you know, if you mess up, you know, come back to me and come and ask for forgiveness, and I'm always here waiting for you.
Right.
So, you know, why would you want to start teaching people? I feel like a lot of people have such a harsh perspective of the religion, and it's not that way at all.
Right. I mean, what we do, because when we discussed how we would want the format of this podcast, is that we're simply two Muslim women offering a thorough analytical assessment of how this has applied in our lives and our perspectives. So note the difference. You know, every individual on earth is entitled to have a perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Not every individual on earth is entitled to preach.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we made that to be very clear in that distinction, is that if you're going to listen to this podcast, you're being offered a perspective in two very different perspectives. Because I think we had an episode where we were kind of comparing ourselves to the other, right? Where I said that I think you're a lot more religiously, for a lack of a better word, conservative than me, despite me being the one who wears hijab.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I have more of a empirical approach to the religion, and you have more of a spiritual approach mm-hmm. to it. And I think both approaches are legitimate, and there's no one size fits all answer to living life. So just wanted to throw that out there. But you know, so this episode we're going to be talking about toxic parenting, because, you know, Dua, I will say that I've gone to many lectures in my life, and a lot of them, even within my own local community, it's always about, you know, how children should treat their parents, you know, because I get it, like, you know, Islamically, like, you know, whatever you do for your parents, the reward is tremendous. And, you know, there's Jannah between your mother's, beneath your mother's feet. You know, having a father figure is, you know, very important in everybody's life. And the role of a parent is a very, very heavy one, and that is a heavy burden to carry. But oftentimes we don't hear how parents often infringe upon the rights of their children. And I think a lot of the times it's intergenerational trauma being inherited from generation to generation,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, a parent might believe, well, my parents did this to me when I was a child. This is how I was disciplined. So I'm going to go by that playbook.
I actually 100% agree with you. There are a lot of times where you hear how children should be treating their parents and being respectful. Because, you know, it's like, yeah, you hit your teenage years. And, you know, especially nowadays, like, they got a lip. You know, like, they like to talk back and all right. of this stuff. And society obviously encourages that. So a lot of scholars will focus on how, you know, basically, you know, talking to kids and telling them, like, you know, you have to be able to, you know, respect your parents because of all of the things that they've done for you and all of these things. And 100% I agree with you, but obviously it's a two-way relationship, right? Any type of relationship is two-way, whether it's a sibling, a parent, you know, husband or wife, whatever it is, right? Even friendship, everything is a two-way relationship. You know, it's not going to be a good solid relationship if only one side is being respected and the other side isn't being respected.
Because you and I, we religiously have the same background, and culturally our backgrounds are very similar too, with maybe a few differences here and there. Because my background is Pakistani, your background is Arab, and both of the cultures are extremely similar.
Yeah.
And I see we can't deny it. Both cultures are extremely conservative to some
extent. Yeah, absolutely.
When it comes to, like, for example, disciplining your children.
Yeah, and I feel like most people who have an Arab or Pakistani parent can say that they've, like, been beaten at some point. I mean, I think all of us can say it. I mean, I would say a good 95% can say that. And then they have, like, all those, like, memes on TikTok and stuff, or, like, what on, I don't know, whatever, Instagram or whatever, you know, of, like, people making fun of their, like, making fun of that, like, how, you know, like, a normal parent would be like, oh, you're going out, like, oh, okay, no big deal. And then, you know, then there's a Pakistani parent, and they're like, oh, I'm going out, like, excuse me, and they're, like, throwing shoes at this person and stuff, you know?
Why is it always a shoe? And it's not always a shoe, it's a slipper, too.
Nice. I mean, I'm trying to think, did I ever get a shoe thrown at me? Probably. I think I did when I was a kid. Yeah. It's funny as an adult now, right? Like, as an adult, it's funny. I remember having a conversation with, like, some of my siblings and, like, kind of reminiscing about, like, you know, those disciplinary measures that were taken by our parents. And, like, at the time, I just remember it being so horrible. And, like, as an adult, it's just funny thinking about it, you know?
And, you know, it's funny is because I think it was a couple of phone calls ago where you were, like, you were telling me how my family is very different from most other Pakistani or Middle Eastern families, because this is going to make a lot of people's heads fall off. I, as a Pakistani woman, have never been beaten in my life.
Yeah, but first of all, your dad wasn't around, you know? Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that plays a major role.
But also,
it's like, I mean, to be honest with you, I think a lot of, I mean, when you're no longer living in that region, it does get different. And I mean, I can't say it was everyone, right? Because there are plenty of people who have been, like, you know, culturally, what's the word? They've integrated, and, you know, so they no longer kind of implement those things that are much more utilized if you're living within that region or whatever. So, I mean, I don't know. I guess it just depends on the family.
It does depend on the family. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of families where the dynamic is a lot healthier. But, you know, being first generation in America, it's definitely going to take a couple of cycles of generation to break out of, you know, that kind of intergenerational trauma.
But you know what's interesting is that for every child that I know that was beaten, like, growing up, and I'm talking about, like, I'm not talking about, like, okay, a slap here and there. I'm talking, like, proper beats, you know?
What does that mean, properly beaten?
Dude, what, for you to ask that question, it means you were never beaten. Yeah. Like, for that to even come out of your mouth, like, what does that mean?
I turned out fine.
For anyone listening that is, like, shaking their head, like, yeah, I got the proper beats, like, they know what I am talking about. For everyone that I know that got beat as a child, like, they refused to beat their own children. Which can be viewed as, like, a positive thing, but, I mean, who knows? Like, maybe that kind of disciplinary action was the reason why, you know, you didn't turn out so bad. I mean, I don't know. I have no idea. There's no way to assess it, right? You know? So it's like, you never know if, like, oh, well, is it because I was beat that I am this way, or is it because I wasn't beat that I am this way? You know what I mean? Like, it's, I don't know.
I think it depends, like, to the extent of beatings, because I think I've told you a story of, like, two boys where they were, like, well into their adulthood. They were never the same after that.
Yeah.
There's a very dichotomous way of looking at disciplining children in our cultures, because they don't think of it as, you know, a spectrum of discipline, right? They think of it as to beat or not to beat. And they don't think how far a beating could go.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the extent of it, of the amount of psychological damage it could cause upon the child, is not, like, a second thought to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's just normal, mm-hmm. you know? It's just like, you know, you freaking slap a slipper across your child's face. It's not just, like, an emotional toll. It sets a seed that is rooted deep within you, and then it begins to fester mm-hmm. as you grow up. So there's this account on Instagram. It's called Brown Girl Trauma. And I saw this thing where it was, I thought it was kind of interesting. This is not, like, a formal, you know, scientific thing, but I think it's so generic that most people would agree, mm-hmm. right? They're comparing the differences between a dysfunctional family versus a functional family. So, like, in a dysfunctional family, you'll have unpredictability and fear. And in a functional family, you'll have it's stable and predictable. It's a caregiving environment. In a dysfunctional family, you have abuse, neglect, household dysfunction. In a functional family, you have a safe and loving space. In a dysfunctional family, you only have conditional love, right? And in a functional family, it's unconditional. In dysfunctional families, there's emotional loneliness. And in functional families, emotionally secure parent-child relationships exist.
Mm-hmm.
In a dysfunctional family, parents have a one-sided emotional eruptions, like anger, right? And in a functional family, parents are not afraid of showing their love and vulnerable feelings. In a dysfunctional family, they'll be quick to tell you why you piss them off, but they'll be hesitant to tell you that they love you. Like, the positive emotions, they're hesitant about, and the negative emotions, they'll let you know very quickly. And then in a dysfunctional family, there's unrealistic expectations. In a functional family, mistakes are allowed and they're nurtured. In a dysfunctional family, there's unhealthy boundaries and there's no emotional autonomy. And I think this one's very important because in a functional family, there are healthy boundaries and parents teach you how to be self-sufficient.
Yeah, I think that that's important.
Right, because parents, a lot of the times, they invest their happiness so much so in their children to such an extent where it's unhealthy.
Yeah, right? In different ways, I guess, yeah.
Well, cause it's like an emotional dependency. I'll give you an example. Have you seen the show 90 Day Fiancé?
No.
It's so funny. It's basically this show about Americans who they'll go travel somewhere or they'll meet somebody online and that person lives abroad and they'll bring them back to America and then they have 90 days to get married to them. Otherwise, that person gets deported.
Mm-hmm.
There's this white woman. She, I guess, fell in love with this Indian man in India who's like 30 years younger than her. This woman's in her 60s or something. You know, she goes to India to meet him and his parents. And he then goes to his parents' house with this white woman. I forget her name. And there is a 30-year age gap between them. And the mom was basically like, if you marry her, I will commit suicide.
Oh, wow.
And then after so much argument, you know, the son kind of hesitates. He's like, oh, crap. Like, I don't know if she's, like, being real or not because I don't want my mom killing herself because I was being selfish and I married my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking, wow, like, the framing of that. He said, because I was being selfish for marrying my wife.
Mm-hmm.
The threat of, like, hey, if you do this, I'm going to commit suicide. To me, in, you know, having grown up here, in my perspective, I think the mom was being selfish.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the mom was being selfish because at the end of the day, it's like you can't be in control of your children. Like, we're put on this earth to, you know, to make our own choices and to be, you know, tested based on the decisions that we've made and to be, you know, kind of, I don't know, like, what's the word? Like, you know, towering over someone and trying to control them and their decisions. That's not okay, and obviously it's not healthy, but additionally, I mean, to some extent, obviously we're supposed to be following what our parents decide. I mean, you know, it's one thing to say, listen, you know, I don't agree with you marrying this person because of these things, and then you list off, you know, 10 reasons why this person would not be a good, you know, partner, or they're not compatible, or why they wouldn't be a good contribution to the family, or whatever. That's one thing. And to make this person think about it from that, like, you're giving them the information they need in order for them to process it and realize, okay, yeah, actually, you're right. This probably isn't the right person for me, and make that decision on their own. But then it's a totally different thing by threatening them. Like, you can't be with this person otherwise, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that obviously that's not, it's not okay. But with just saying that, there was, you mentioned, like, loving your children too much, because that's the problem, isn't it? It's like these women, I don't know if it's about loving the children. I feel like it's more so about controlling them. I mean, I feel like you see it in the Pakistani community a lot. You also see it in the Arab kind of community as well, where, you know, somebody gets married and then the parents are just like backseat drivers of the marriage, and they're trying to control everything. Like, they're trying to control, you know, how their son treats his wife and this and that, and it just becomes a huge mess, and, you know, they're actually just making more problems. And obviously, that, like, that in itself is not healthy. But also, you know, what's her name? Yasmin, the one who wrote the book Reclaim Your Heart.
Yasmin Mujahid.
Yes, she gave a speech, and I actually think it's in the book as well. I can't remember. An amazing book. I recommend it. It's called Reclaim Your Heart. She talks about how, okay, our heart is like a vessel, right? And it's meant to be just like how in a car, you've got the gas tank, which needs to be filled up with the correct, you know, thing, which is petroleum, right? Or petrol. And so, you know, when you start to fill up your gas tank with orange juice, then something starts to malfunction in the car, right? So, or just like wouldn't even work. So when we take our heart, and which is supposed to be filled with the love of Allah and the trust of Allah and all of these things, you know, we as Muslims, like we are submitting ourselves to Allah, and we're saying, you know, I am your slave, and I'm, you know, I'm committing myself to your rules and your regulations and how you've asked us to live our life. And so you're submitting yourself to Him. When you start to view the world as, you know, in your heart you've placed maybe your spouse or your children or materialistic things or whatever, then you know, Allah's gonna take that and Allah's gonna test you with it, right? Oh, you think this person's better than me? Okay, let me take them away from you. Let's see how you react now. Mm-hmm. You know? And so, I mean, she does, I probably did a really, really, really horrible job of summarizing her lecture, but that's basically kind of how she describes it. And it's true, right? Because when you're so enveloped and engulfed in something, and it's like the only thing that matters to you, it's like the harder you try to hold on to something, the easier it slips out of your hands, right? And so I think that that's something you have to be very careful with, because, you know, from a perspective of a mother who, you know, her mm-hmm. son just gets married and she's just, you know, jealous of the wife. Oh, you're taking my son away from me. I mean, actually, I feel like the harder she tries to keep him, you know, the easier he'll slip away, because he'll see or he'll feel like she's trying to control him and his wife isn't trying to control him. You know, and he'll feel like, well, I want to be with somebody who isn't trying to control me.
Which is weird, because I've seen the opposite happen too. I've seen both extremes happen, because I've also seen the extreme where it's like, you know, you marry into a family. I'm going to put, like, since I'm a woman, I'll just put it from my perspective. If I marry into a family, and let's say this family is, I've seen the scenario play out a bunch of times where the family is of the belief that once you get married, you are now the property of the family you married into.
Yeah.
And they completely cut you off from your own family, right? And so it's like your husband or your spouse, whoever it may be, wife, whatever, has engulfed you so much entirely into their own world that they have completely cut you off from your own.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that play out too. And both are unhealthy. And usually it's always has to do with the parents from one side or the other, where there's this expectation that my daughter-in-law and son-in-law, I now have authority over them.
Mm-hmm.
When reality, even like if you want to put religion into it, even Islamically, you don't have any obligation to your parental in-laws, and mm-hmm. they don't have any obligation towards you.
Mm-hmm.
So, but even put religion aside, even culturally, is the social contract is always between one individual to another individual. Yeah, the families come along for the ride. You know, it'd be nice if everyone got along. And, you know, there's that certain level of respect. Even though this is a marriage between us, I still come with a family, and so do you. But mm-hmm. it's never so that one person entirely owns the other and their entire existence, or one family entirely owns the person that married into them.
It could be anything. I mean, I think just understanding that, like, you can't control your children, you know, for everything.
Well, that kind of goes back to the point where it's like you shouldn't raise your children to become codependent on you. You should raise them in a way where they become adults, self-sufficient adults. Right.
I mean, with that being said, it's important to when your child does make a bad decision or a bad choice, what you consider to be a bad decision or a bad choice or the wrong decision, you know, you're not reprimanding them in the wrong way as well. Because a lot of the times, you know, if you're, you know, coming at them, screaming at them, yelling at them, they're going to feel like it's going to kind of close those doors for them to want to share things with you. And then actually you're just kind of hurting your relationship more and more. And as that continues, then the less they're going to share with you and talk to you and stuff like that. So I think it's really important that, like, if your child is sharing something with you that you don't particularly like to hear, like you don't really, this isn't something that you're happy about, like they're giving you information that's upsetting to you, instead of just immediately like, what, why, you know, blah, blah, and just freaking out, I, you know, just calmly, you know, taking a moment to breathe and then, you know, try to understand. I'll give you an example. So there's this lady, she kind of just talks about, you know, being a female, you know, a Muslim woman raising children and things like that. She talks about multiple things regularly. She's got like a YouTube channel and she's got all of these things. But I forgot her name and I couldn't seem to find her. Anyway, she's pretty amazing if you end up figuring out who I'm talking about. Anyway, she does this talk where basically she gives a story about how her son, who's like a teenager, came home and she ends up finding out that he has a girlfriend. And so again, very conservative Muslim family, of course, wasn't happy to hear this information. But instead of her freaking out on him, she sits down with him and she says, you know, well, she thinks to herself, okay, well, I can either freak out about this and I can potentially ruin my relationship with my son and then he's going to stop telling me what's going on in his personal life. But, you know, alhamdulillah, I've developed a really good relationship with him over the years. He trusts me enough to tell me about the fact that he has a girlfriend, which is amazing, right? Because I feel like a lot of kids nowadays, especially in the West, like wouldn't even have that conversation with their parents. They would hide it and they would keep it to themselves. So, you know, so clearly she's developed a really good relationship with him over the years and he trusts her enough to have this conversation with her. And so she says, so I sat him down, you know, I didn't want to ruin anything. So I sat him down and I said, okay, like, you know, how do you feel about this girl? And he was talking about her and, you know, I really like her and this and that. And she says, but, you know, you understand that we are Muslims. And he says, yes, I know. And but I really like her. And his mother was like, well, you know, there are a couple of different ways that we can go about it. You know, so the first way, if you really, really like her, then, you know, you can tell you can bring her over and you can introduce her to me and I can get to know her and I can meet her parents and we can discuss, you know, doing things halal and, you know, getting you guys to do the nikah. Like, that's an option. Right. Keep in mind, we're talking about like a 16, 17 year old. Like teenage boy. And she's like, so that's an option. Or the other option is that because, you know, we do have our Islamic values and we have our morals and, you know, we know that Allah has restricted us from being in these like unhealthy relationships and waiting for our spouse, because, you know, the reason why we wait for our spouse is so that we can be halal for them. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, we can have a healthy relationship with them. And, you know, if that's the case, you know, what do you think, you know, if like, what do you think is the best way of approaching that? And he was like, well, I don't think I'm supposed to have a girlfriend. And she's like, well, I want you to think about it. Like, you know, I want you to think about the options in front of you and think about how you want to approach it and come back to me by next week. And then we'll talk about it again. So she gives him the opportunity to like analyze the situation himself. Right. And he comes back a week later and he says to her, like, you know, and she said during this week, I would make sure that he was praying with me. I would make sure like we sat down and we read Quran together. You know, so I was like really enforcing, like not controlling or anything, but just really enforcing and reiterating the Islamic mm-hmm. values that we have in the household. And so then he comes back to her and he says to her, like a week later, he says, yes, I really, really like her, but I know that you're right. And I'm too young to get married because, you know, like I have, you know, I want to go off to college and I want to do all of these things before I get married. And so, you know, I've decided that I'm going to tell her that like we can be friends. And so he made this decision on his own. And I don't know what happened after that. There was never like an update version that I saw of it. So I don't know if that was something he stuck to or he didn't stick to. I don't know. But I think that just that in general, like being calm about it and having a healthy conversation and like giving them control, that is so important. When you're a teenager, you feel like everyone wants to control you. Mom wants to tell me what to do. Dad wants to tell me what to do. Siblings want to tell me what to do. Everyone wants to tell, my teachers want to tell me what to do. I can't make my own decisions. And it's like frustrating for you, especially if you grow up in the West where this isn't, you know, it's like at some point, you know, kind of society allows you to like make your own decisions, right? And so, you know, it's really, really frustrating. So when you put that power back into their hands and you allow them to analyze it, you treat them like an adult, right? Like you would treat a 30-year-old like this. You would say, okay, well, how do you feel about it? Like, why are you thinking that way? Like what's, you know, you try to figure it out and you try to help them figure it out. Yeah. Do the exact same way. If you're going to be yelling at your child and trying to control them, it's not going to get you anywhere. And probably you'll see a lot more pushback. because they don't like the fact that they're being controlled. And that's probably the biggest reason why they're becoming, like, what's the word? They're
rebellious.
Yes, rebellious. They're becoming rebellious simply because they dislike the fact that you're trying to control them. And they're at a period, they're at a very fragile period in their life where they are turning into a man or they're turning into a woman, and they want to feel like they have control of things in their own life.
This idea is encompassing of every type of ideology out there. Whether you're Muslim or you're, you know, atheist, it doesn't matter. The role of a parent, because you see this in nature, is to set the stage for your child to no longer depend on you at some point, right?
Mm-hmm.
So your role is to equip them with the tools they need to the point where once they are completely set free,
mm-hmm.
right,
mm-hmm.
that they can be positive members of society that contribute to society in a positive and healthy way, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
So that's your role as a parent, is to equip them to become autonomous one day.
And to be honest with you, that begins at a very young age, because I've worked with young, very young children, and you see parents who are extremely controlling. Like, they don't let their kids, we're talking about between the ages of, you know, 0 and 4, okay? You know, if you're not allowing your child mm-hmm. to, like, play in the mud and, you know, like, do what they want, like, and I'm not talking about to the extreme. I'm not talking about allowing your child to hit you or anything. I'm just talking about, you know, let him play. He wants to play with the ball outside, okay, let him play with the ball outside, you know, like, give him some sort of free reins. If he another really big one is temper tantrums. A lot of parents don't know how to deal with temper tantrums, and I'm telling you right now, as somebody who has an education in this field with young children, I also have worked with young children for years, a few years earlier, and the biggest thing that I'll tell you about when a child is having a temper tantrum is two things. First, you let them let it out, because, you know, you have to realize that a young child, they don't know how to control their emotions the same way that we as adults do, because their emotions and these feelings for them are very new, right? This is a new experience for them. They don't know how to control these feelings of things that are overwhelming. So if, you know, your child starts screaming and crying, give them a few minutes to just let it out. Like, you know, because it's the same with us, right? Like, if you're so angry mm-hmm. or you're so sad and you're holding it in, it just builds up and builds up and builds up, and it's a problem. But if you take a minute to step aside and just start crying, or you take a minute to, you know, go outside and just start screaming, like, then you feel better because you're actually letting it out. And then once you've let that anger out in some form, then you can, like, say, okay, I can think clearly now, let me assess the situation, and then you can think properly. Children are the exact same way. So let them do that, then then talk to them the same way you would talk to an adult. Why do you feel this way? Why are you crying? Tell me what's upsetting you. I don't understand, so you need to explain to me why you're upset, because I don't know why you're upset. And once you start talking to them, just the normal conversation, none of this, oh, stop crying, you're a boy, why are you crying? None of this. It doesn't help. You need to have okay, I understand and I can see that you're very frustrated. Can you please explain to me what happened for you to feel that way? You know, and then they start talking, and when they start talking, they start to also calm down, because they feel like they are allowed to be in control of their emotions by explaining to you how they feel. So this is really, really important.
Right, because, you know, by default, children are not very eloquent. So it's like their form of expressing frustration or anger is usually through whining and crying. And so you as an adult have to kind of guide them through expressing that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And guiding them, teaching them those skills at a really young age, I'm telling you, it's benefiting them for their entire adult life. If you refuse to teach them those skills at a young age, like, let's say a child is crying and, for example, a lot of parents, like, when they're out at the store and their kids start to throw a temper tantrum, they'll just give them whatever they want just to make them stop talking or stop crying or whatever, because they don't want to look like a bad parent in front of other people, right? So it's like, it's very selfish, isn't it? So you're actually, what you're doing is you're contributing to your child to understand.
You're rewarding bad behavior.
Exactly. You're rewarding bad behavior. And now the child understands, oh, I can scream and cry whenever I want and I'll get what I want. And then now you've got this horrible habit that's going to be, it's going to be continuous. And then you're going to have that to deal with. So what you need to, you know, you're at the store, who cares? This is a child. There is not a single person in the world that is going to walk up to you and be like, your child is screaming, make them stop. Like, it's not going to happen. Let him or her scream or cry for a few minutes. Just let them let it out for a second, or, you know, 30 seconds or a minute or whatever. And then talk to them. Look them in the eye. You need to get on eye level. You need to look them in the eye and be like, okay, I can see that you're very upset. Please explain to me what you're upset about. And then they're going to talk to you about it. And you're going to say, a lot of parents, they use the words, because I said so. And that is extremely wrong. A child, that's controlling. Well, you're controlling the situation.
Right. There's...
Sorry, you need to allow the child to. You need to allow the child to understand it and interpret it themselves. So what instead you would say is, let's say for example, your child wants a toy at the store, and the child says, "Okay, you know," and then they start screaming and crying because they want this toy. So okay, you let them let it out for a minute, and then you, like I said, get down to their level. If they're sitting in the cart, you know, bend down a little bit and look at them in the eyes, not in an aggressive way, just in a normal way. And okay, I see that you're very upset. What's going on? Why are you crying? Okay, I'm crying because I want this toy. And you're gonna say, I understand that you want this toy, but. And then you have to fill in the blank. Why is it that you're not giving them the toy? I'm not going to buy you this toy because at the other store, I bought you another toy. And today you only get one toy because otherwise that's not fair. So the next toy you can get is in 2 days if you're a good boy. Right? So you explain it to them. If you explain it to them, then all of a sudden, okay, so there's a reason why I'm not getting the toy. It's not because mom says that I'm not getting the toy and mom's just being a bitch about it, right?
There's something I want to kind of touch on, which you just mentioned, right? So that one form of control is just, you know, telling them to, like, shut up, or because I said so, or whatever. You just want to, you know, put a lid on the situation. I've seen this happen a lot, too, where, you know, it's... This happens a lot in brown households. So I kind of want to reel it back to the culture. They try to justify why they hit their children because they think it's healthy, right? But you have to ask yourself, if you think that is a healthy form of parenting, ask yourself why you think that is. Because in my opinion, if there's like 50 different avenues of disciplining a child and your go-to one is the easiest form of discipline, because we all know a good slap will shut anybody up, right? You have to ask yourself why you think as a parent that you're slapping your child or you're hitting your child to get them to shut up. Do you honestly think that's good for them? Because I will guarantee you that if you're someone who says, I use physical discipline for my child because it builds character in them or it builds discipline in them, like, I guarantee you the deep down reason isn't for you you know, trying to build your child's character. It's because you are annoyed and you want the fastest solution possible to put a lid on a noisy situation.
Well, and a lot of times actually it's because the parent themselves struggles with dealing with their emotions, and it's cyclical.
Yeah, because they have a short fuse as well. Yeah. Because you as a parent, you're annoyed. So actually you're slapping that child for yourself, right? Because you have self-discipline issues. You have a short fuse. You don't want to put the emotional and psychological investment of trying to maneuver the situation in such a way where you can, in a healthy fashion, discipline this child without hurting them psychologically or physically. Because that requires some effort. Slapping a child, that has almost no effort on your part. Because you know that'll work. That'll easily put a lid on a noisy situation. Hitting your children is more of a reflection of your discipline, of your character, rather than your child's character. That's how I...
Well, yeah, I agree with you completely. And I have a degree in psychology, more specifically like forensic psychology and different things. But a lot of that is geared towards, you know, people who kind of struggle with, you know, when you're talking about crimes and things that take place, you know, a lot of the reasons why people commit crimes are because of, yeah, some sort of emotional something that was kind of built up for a long period of time, usually beginning in childhood and then just kind of escalating throughout the years. And then, yeah, it's not cyclical. It's like it grows. It's like, I don't know how to, it's like a snowball. Right? So basically what happens is, like, you hit them once and the child, let's say you saw the child stop, right? And inside of you, okay, you got a little bit of like a release of some of your anger because you physically got to let it out on someone, right? So you got the reciprocation of them stopping to cry because now they're scared of you. And so now the next time it's going to happen again, right? And you're going to do it again because, oh, I felt better because I got to let it out of me. And the child's going to stop crying because the child's scared of you, right? And so the next time you're going to do it again, but this time you're going to let more out. And you're going to hit them harder and you're going to beat them longer. And then the more it happens over the years, it becomes worse and worse and worse and worse. And eventually, there's no relationship there anymore. I mean, this child isn't going to respect you. They're not going to trust you. They're not going to want to talk to you about anything. They're probably going to have, some form of hatred towards you internally. But so, you know, these are things that you have to be very careful with, because as soon as you hit someone once, I mean, it's done then.
Yeah, you've set a precedent. And going off of that, I kind of want to talk about emotional abuse, because, I mean, physical abuse, we know that's common in Arab and Pakistani households. But emotional abuse is in many ways a lot trickier, and it's oftentimes worse. And I know this is true for my culture, and you can tell me if this is also true for Arab culture. I think it is. You know, emotional abuse, you know, that looks like the silent treatment, constant comparison of your children with other kids or their siblings, right? Or unrealistic expectations of them,
mm-hmm.
right? Or guilt tripping them, having an invasion of privacy. Like, you've set the tone that children are not allowed to have privacy up until the age of, like, 45, mm-hmm. I guess. And then emotional blackmail mm-hmm. is a huge one. And then constantly using parents know what is best for their children to navigate mm-hmm. important decisions. Like, you know, using that line, I as a parent know what's best for you, it has become like the end-all be-all of all, decision-making. I remember, I kind of realized that adults could be wrong when... Because, you know, when you're a child, they portray this image of themselves to you that they're so wise that they almost always hit the mark, like 99% of the time. They never have a lapse in judgment. They're never wrong. And because you've been safe and sound so far in your life, you're not really all that aware of your surroundings, of how bad things actually are. They just seem like the smartest person in the room. And then when you grow up a little, you yourself become an adult, you're like, oh, wow, they're just as much of capable of error as much as I am. If your parents are constantly drilling into your head that your parents always know what's best for you, eventually there comes that age where you realize that's not true. They want what's best for you. They don't always necessarily know what's best for you.
Like I said, it's like the harder you try to like grip your claws into them, it's like the more pushback you're going to get as they get older. Maybe not right now. Like maybe, okay, you know, they're 10, they're 15. Like, all right, fine. You know, there's a sense of power that they're going to feel that you have over them because, you know, they live in your house. They, you know, you're the one who provides and whatever. But at some point, eventually, they're going to not have that anymore, and they're not going to feel that way anymore. And so, like, when, you know, 18 comes around, 20 comes around, 25, maybe they won't even speak to you anymore because you know, you didn't make me feel good when I was with you, so I don't want to have you around in my life anymore. So, I mean, but with that being said, it's like, I mean, just kind of, because I don't want this whole talk to be so negative, I want to kind of touch on just the relationship, because it's not always just about, you know, some sort of domestic violence or, you know, something like that. That's not always the case. Sometimes it's just a situation where there's a lack of communication, there's a lack of transparency. And I remember growing up, my mother was very, very, very busy. She had, you know, my dad was traveling because of work, and so he did a lot of traveling, and so my mom, you know, was raising her children. You know, we were teenagers at the time, and, you know, which isn't, I mean, for any parent who's had teenagers, obviously they know that it can be quite difficult. But she worked a lot because she had her own businesses, and so she wasn't really home much during my teenage years. And I remember, you know, she did the best that she could. And, you know, she, I mean, for all of our parents that have done everything that they can in their power to like make us be where we are today and like, you know, grow us up and give us confidence and give us strength and, you know, be support, like, you know, may Allah reward all of them and may Allah grant them the highest rankings in Jannah for everything that they've done for us. Ameen. But, you know, she wasn't really there for me much at that time. And I feel like for a teenage girl, you know, you really, you look up to your mom, you need your mom. mom for, you know, certain things and, you know, certain girly advices and stuff like this. And it's not that she was dismissive, but it was like, you know, she comes home after work and I see that she's tired, she's exhausted, she just wants to rest. So it's like, oh, I'm not gonna bug her, you know? So it was more of like this kind of distance that ended up developing between us. And I felt like I couldn't really talk to her about things because, you know, because of that. And I remember in my teenage years thinking, like, I wish that I was close with my mom, because I saw that my friends had, like, really good relationships with their mothers, and, like, they could talk to their moms about, like, their boyfriends, and they could talk to their moms about these things. And I just remember, like, not ever feeling like I could really talk to my mom about anything. Not because she wouldn't have been there. I know that she would have been there. It's almost like, you know, like I said, that snowball effect, right? Like, it happens a couple times, and then it just keeps going, and it keeps going, and then eventually you kind of get into this kind of rut of like, oh, well, I haven't ever talked to her about anything. So now if I just come to her and say, like, mom, I want to talk to you about this that's going on at school, she's going to be like, what? You know what I mean? Like, so then you feel uncomfortable. And especially when you're a teenager, you get uncomfortable very easily. Like, I feel like teenagers, like, overanalyze, like, everything. And they've scientifically proven why teenagers do that. There's different parts of the brain that are developing at different rates at that time in their age. And therefore, they think that everything is, like, a huge deal. Like, they think that, you know, if they do something bad, like, they're going to be punished horribly for it, and, like, it's over exaggerated just because of the way that their brain is developing at that time. So the reason why teenagers act the way that they act, there's a reason for it. And my advice to people, and the advice that I try to implement with my own son, is that, you know, it's like, be somebody who can talk to them. Like, you have to show them, you have to take the steps yourself, right? Like, a teenager is never going to come up to you and be like, hey, mom, I need to tell you about something, right? Unless you've developed that relationship with them. So you need to, like, you know, okay, you come home from work and just start talking to them. Be like, you want to hear about what happened to me at work? And just start talking. Like, even if you know that they don't know, even if you know that they don't care, even though you know that maybe this information you're giving them is a little bit above their head, just do it anyway. Like, talk to them about your presentations at work, talk to them about your friends, your coworkers, talk to them about these things. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, what's going to happen is that now, eventually, when it gets to the point where you're like, okay, what happened today for you? What happened at school today, they're not going to be like, oh, nothing. They're going to be like, damn, she just talked for like an hour, like, I have to say something, you know? And they're going to start talking too. They're going to be like, okay, well, this happened, or this went on with this friend, or I don't really like this teacher, you know? And you're developing that relationship. And so when something really goes wrong, like, they're in a situation where maybe they're being pressured to do drugs or to have sex or to, I don't know, make poor choices, they're going to be like, I need to go to mom, or I need to go to dad, like, for their advice. They're going to want your advice, because they know that, okay, you come to me for advice about your work stuff, so I can go to you for advice about my school stuff.
Right. And, well, I mean, that's a good way to look at it, because sometimes the distance just happens without any conflict.
Right, exactly.
Sometimes there's this uneasy feeling there, and no one knows where it comes from, right? I'll give you an example, and this is something that's been happening between me and my mom lately. Where, you know, my mom is widowed, she's older now, so the dynamic is reversed. I never confide in my mom. She always confides in me. And I, you know, she's a woman who's been through a lot, and I don't know many people who've been through what she has been through. And now that I'm an adult, I'm in my late 20s, as I'm approaching my 30s, I think to myself, like, this woman has been through it, and I don't feel comfortable putting my baggage on her already overflowing plate, you know? So I just tend not to do that. But that, in a way, it's a little weird, because it's like she confides in me so much, so to the point where I sometimes feel overwhelmed. I'm like, what do I do about this?
What you're talking about is different, because you're an adult woman. How do I say this? It's not necessarily that you're, like, coming to her, looking up to her in a sense in that regard, but it's almost like, you know, for guidance. And there are times in our life where we do, right? Even in our, like, 40s or 50s, we'll look up to our parents for guidance. But you're doing it out of respect for, like, the stress on your mom. And you're just like, no, it's best for me not to have this conversation with her because I don't want to stress her out or whatever, right? But that's different than when you're talking about you as a teenager, right? Because when we're teenagers, we're constantly making poor choices. Because we're young and we're learning, you know, and we need someone to guide us through it.
Right, right. But the reason I bring that point up in my adulthood is that eventually things do reverse. When your parents get old enough, or they're beaten down by life so much at some point where they no longer have the emotional temerity to, you know, be that, you know, be that fountain of confiding in them, like that no longer exists, because, you know, they're a little downtrodden at this point. And, you know, it's different for every parent. Maybe they'll reach that point when they're in their 80s or in their 60s. It doesn't matter. But at some point when they feel like,
right,
and this happens a lot when a parent feels like they're nearing death, where they may feel like death for them is like about 10 years away, 15 years away. My children used to need me. Now I feel like I need them.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Right. And that's the light, this, what is it? The circle of life.
Yeah, that's the cycle of life, y'all. But, you know, kind of going back to the teenage years, because those are the most critical years, of course, because you're setting them up for adulthood. I want to go back to what emotional abuse looks like, right? And like I said, this is very prevalent in brown and Arab households, where we do this thing where we constantly compare our children to the other. Or like, you know, your friend's kid, or, you know, your other kid. I know of a family who had a daughter who constantly compared their daughter to me, you know? They would always tell her, like, oh, why can't you just be like a Froze? You're, you know.
Can I just guess and say that she probably hates you because of it?
Yeah, she does.
Yeah, that's obvious.
Well, she doesn't hate me now. But when we were teenagers, it was the weirdest thing because I had never done anything to her. And so, because, you know, I was a goody two-shoes straight-A student in high school, and she was, like, she was a normal kid. Like, she didn't do anything wrong. But, you know, she wasn't nearly as, I guess, like, academically disciplined as what I was, and that's okay. Every child is built differently, looks like, right? So, like, the comparison of children, or whether it's between siblings or whatever, in my opinion, is extremely toxic. Because it's one of those things where you have to understand that each one of your children, let's say you have four children, right? They're all different from one another. They have different personalities. And a lot of times parents don't see that their children are just organically different from one another.
Mm-hmm.
And so comparing them to one another is just extremely toxic.
Mm-hmm.
Another example I want to give is, this is extremely toxic, where I see, you know, a child having a dream to be like, you know, some untraditional thing that they want to be one day, you know. I'll give you an example. I have a cousin. He wants to be a computer scientist because he's really good at computers. But his father is like, no, you're going to be a pilot, because he likes planes. He likes the airline industry. He's fascinated with that. So he's kind of projecting the things that he likes onto his son. And I told my uncle, I was like, you know what the biggest mistake you could do is to not capitalize on a natural talent that your kid already has and divert them in a direction where they have no talent.
Yeah. So I'll give you an example with my own son. So, you know, if you've been following us from the beginning, you've probably heard me talk about the fact that I have a child and stuff. And so you know that I have a kid, but if you don't, I have a kid. And so my son, I remember when I was pregnant, and I remember, like, because I was very young, I got married when I was very young, I was pregnant, I was still a teenager when I was pregnant, and I remember, you know, just as a teenager, like, you know, you've got these kind of theories in your head, like, I liked skater boys and this and that, so I wanted my son to grow up to be, like, a skater boy, and I liked sports, so I wanted him to be into sports, and, you know, like, I had my envisionment of what I wanted him to be, right? And then my son came out completely different than me. We don't have anything that we both like at the same time. For example, like, I like sports, he doesn't like sports. I am not musically inclined, and my son is extremely musically inclined. He plays multiple instruments. I had two options. I mean, I could sit there and I could be really depressed that, you know, he doesn't have any hobbies or any interests that I have, or mm-hmm. I could sit there and I could say, okay, what is he good at? What does he like to do? And how do I make him excel in that, you know? So instead of me saying, oh, you like instruments, but I don't like instruments, so instead of playing this instrument, you're gonna go play soccer, you know? I decided, okay, all right, it's not his thing. And I'm gonna be supportive of him for that.
I've also seen the dynamic where it's like, you had one kid who's extremely successful in one thing, so you want all the other kids to do the same thing. which I'm just like, you got to let people follow their own path.
It's like, just because you are assuming that, you know, oh, this person, they're not at the right place or this or that. It's like, no, man, like they've got so many years ahead of them. Like, just, you know, everyone needs their time to spread their wings. So let them spread their wings at their own time.
Right. And that kind of addresses the component of having unrealistic expectations too on your kid. But I want to also touch on how, like, oftentimes parents can be so dismissive of their child's feelings, you know? Okay, so this one's kind of personal, but I'll use this as an example. When I was growing up, my mom wanted me to become like a scholar, right? Like an Islamic scholar. And my ideas on Islam growing up were very different than hers. And I just didn't want to be a scholar. But then, you know, my brother, my older brother, he delved into that. And, you know, he ended up becoming an hafiz and I didn't. And we started out, you know, learning. I don't know if Arabs have this, but we have something called the Qaida, which is like, pre-Quran, there's this other book where we learn, like, you know, the alphabets and stuff. Yeah. Because mostly non-Arabic speakers use that as, like, a prereq to the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as we were in Sunday school and we were kind of going to transitioning to the Quran, he didn't do, what are they called? Where you just read it? Is it Nazra? I think. There's Hivs and I forget what the other one is called. I know the name is just escaping my brain.
I don't know.
Well, but for our non-Muslim listeners, what that means is there's two ways to read the Quran. One is like you simply read it through and through. And the other is like you memorize the whole book from like cover to cover. Right? And he started off doing that. Like he didn't even bother reading it first and then memorizing it. He just page one, memorizing from there on. And me, I was just reading it. And she was just like, she was just so disappointed in me because she was like, I feel like you're not, you know, stepping into your faith and all of this. Those were her ideas about it. I didn't want to be a scholar. That's just not a dream that I had for myself. And growing up, she really struggled with that because what she took that as was my child is so blasphemous that she does not want to be a scholar. When I'm just like, no, I just want to be a regular Muslim. But my brother had it. Like, he was, it's not that he had to manifest that motivation, that dream within himself. It was already there. So if something's already naturally there, you would capitalize upon that. And then there's this other thing that parents tend to do where it's like emotional blackmail. And where it's like I gave that 90-day fiancé example, where if you don't do something, they let you know how this is affecting them. And they let you know that you are ruining my life because you have done this.
Mm-hmm.
When really, it doesn't actually affect them in any way. Whether it's like changing your major in college, you've decided to marry a girl that they don't approve of, or whatever.
I think it's really a matter of like encouraging your child to like understand the repercussions of their decisions. Like, you don't need to do any of this, you know, BS of like, okay, I'm gonna emotionally blackmail them and make them feel bad and this and that just so that they don't do this because I don't want them to do it because of this. And maybe in the back of your head you have legitimate reasons, you know, like, okay, I don't want my son to marry her because she's, you know, she's got an attitude, she's disrespectful, she's not gonna raise the children.
Well,
Muslim.
A lot of times
you know,
the reasons
it's like,
is not, well, a lot of the times the reasons is like something like it's like you're selfish. Reading a resume. It's like
it's,
oh.
It's usually something selfish. Like, but the thing is I'm not going to disregard the fact where there are times when parents do have a legitimate reason for this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that when you have a legitimate reason, instead of you know playing these kind of games with your child, right, these emotional and mental games with your child, you know, just have a conversation and throw it onto them so that they understand like why you are reacting the way you're reacting. Okay, I have a problem with you marrying her because I see these qualities in her that I know will not give you a successful marriage. I see these qualities that I know will make her not a good parent to your children or a good wife to you or whatever. And I'm worried about that, you know? So it's like, if you're talking to your child transparently and having this conversation, that conversation is going to be way more constructive than if you're yelling at them and no, you can't, I don't accept this, that. It's like, they may just go behind your back and do it anyway.
also, a lot of the times, the assessment of, like, your child's significant other is, I've seen this happen a lot, where it's like a resume. It's not necessarily character qualities. It's rather, you know, they don't have, like, the same profession as their kid, or there's, like, a, you know, one child is Sunni, the other child is Shia, or there's this concept of, like, you know, a woman not being womanly enough, like, you know, maybe she can't bear children, or she's not so inclined in the kitchen, she'd rather work, or, you know, something so arbitrary like that. When really, it's like these small little chores and tasks that are divvied up, it should be only solely
between. Yeah, but
between.
Think about it. If you're the guy, like, let's just, okay, for example, let's say you're the guy, your mom has told you, okay, I don't want you marrying her because of, and she lists some of the reasons that you say, or you've said. And, you know, and if they're having a constructive conversation, she's not yelling at him, she's not, you know, whatever, coming at him aggressively in any way, shape, or form. She's just informing him her thoughts. Now, I feel like he would be able to, at that point, instead of feeling attacked, he would be able to say, like, okay, I understand why you feel this way, and actually I respect the fact that you're bringing this up to me, because obviously you care about me enough and my future children enough to, you know, even be thinking this far ahead, right? But at the end of the day, I realize that, you know, maybe she can't cook, but, you know, it doesn't bug me because I can cook. Or, you know, and it's like, and reassuring each other, you know, he has the opportunity then inform her, like, listen, I understand that these are some of your concerns, but they're not my concerns because of these mm-hmm. reasons, you
well,
know?
There's that. That's a good way to put it. And there's also, like, that, you know, there's, like, a saying in Urdu, like, lo kya kahenge, which means what will people think, you know? And, you know, as adult children of, like, dysfunctional families, I think, you know, as a listener, you might think to yourself, like, am I being guilted into making my family look good? Like, should I not rock the boat here? Don't question anything that your parents are saying. Don't let the family secret slip and just adapt to your community's toxic environment, right? Because a lot of the times it's more so about the family image rather than your family actually having a healthy dynamic. And, you know, and that manifests itself in several different ways, right? Because it doesn't matter what your family looks like on the outside. If certain elements are toxic within the home, but you're just putting, like, this rosy lens over the whole situation, then you're going to suffer than you would normally, right? Like, you know, if you're like, living in a dysfunctional home may mean, like, parents think they having boundaries means you're rejecting them, or you feel pressured with shame and guilt or fear that, you know, if you say anything that your parents just that are against your parents' values from the values that they brought from abroad is, like, somehow too destructive of their worldview, or your parents just want you to have the same beliefs and values as them. You are forced into each other's issues. You're blamed for their behavior. Or, you know, like, for example, if your father genuinely has a heart attack, I've seen this happen in, like, TV dramas, they'll blame it on the child. Well, he had a heart attack because you married the woman that you wanted to marry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or, like, there's just overall limited empathy and emotional loneliness. If you already have a very toxic family dynamic, you as a child decide to marry and you bring someone else into your family dynamic, think to yourself, like, how is this going to impact my spouse too? Because obviously you care about them like you should, right? And what's also very funny to me is when toxic parents are like, we don't need to see a therapist. Because in our communities, like, mental health, they think of it as a joke to some extent. They, in fact, think that you're crazy for seeing a therapist. Like they don't want anything to do with you. Like, it's a taboo. Like, you're the crazy one for seeing a therapist, so therefore, I'm not going to associate with you. Toxic parents also put their emotional baggage at the feet of their children. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, your kid is not a therapist.
I mean, there's a couple of things. It's like, you know, recognizing that, you know, you can't control everything. And we're not meant to control everything, right? Because Islamically, from an Islamic perspective, we know that we're meant to, like, okay, do our best. But after that, put it in the hands of God, right? And Allah is the one who we rely on for doing, you know, helping us with the things that are going on in our life that we don't accept or that we're having difficulty with or whatever. So, you know, just, you know, let's say, for example, you know, your child's about to marry someone you don't like, or, you know, you've got a teenager and this teenager is very rebellious, or you've got a child and this child is like a kid, you know, young child, and this child, you know, struggles with, like, a lot of temper tantrums that you're, you know, having difficulty with or something. It's like, just know that step number one, communication. And I know that that's hard to say, but you as the adult need to be the one who initiates it, because the child isn't going to initiate it, because first of all, they probably don't know how. And second of all, you're the role model. You need to be the adult and you need to be the role model, and you need to show them how you expect them to communicate with you is how you need to communicate with them, right? It's a two-way thing. When you, it's like in a relationship, right? You're married to somebody, you want them to respect you. It's kind of like a two-way thing, right? You respect them and you expect respect from them, and vice versa, right? It's the same thing with your child. I'm not saying that you guys are on the same level, because you're not, right? Your child obviously looks up to you. Your child sees you as a role model. Your child is gonna, come to you for advice. You're not on the same level. But the moment that you start showing them that you respect them, it's gonna help with the communication, and it's gonna help to develop a really good relationship with them. I think that that's step number one. I think that that's like the beginning point. And if it's something that you still really struggle with, or it's kind of at a point where it's, you feel like it's non-salvageable and it's just been kind of destroyed to like a really bad level, maybe because there's physical abuse involved or like whatever, emotional abuse involved, you can go get help. And it doesn't need to be where, the entire community knows and then you feel like you're being, criticized for your decision to go seek help. It could be something that you do like undercover, like nobody needs to know about it. I mean, I remember when I was married to my second husband, he really struggled with anger. He was extremely angry all the time. And I suggested to him, for 2 years straight, our entire marriage, I was suggesting to him, like, let's go to a counselor. Like, I'll help you. I'm not saying you do it on your own. I'm saying that I'm your spouse. I'm here. I want to help you. I want to help you fix things. Like, I'll go with you. Let's do this together. And he just, because of the cultural reasons that you brought up earlier, he refused. He was like, no, people will think that I have, this and blah, 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 and my family will think this of me. And he just completely refused. And I mean, honestly, had he jumped on that opportunity the first time I brought it up to him, we'd probably still be married, because he probably would have been able to learn to deal with his anger and we probably would still be married. But he refused. He flat out refused. And as a result of that, yeah, we're divorced. And so you have to realize that, not everything is about you. Not everything. You can't be selfish. You have to think about, okay, how is this going to impact my relationship with this person in a year from now, or in 5 years from now, or in 10 years from now? Are they still going to want to be in my life if I continue to treat them this way?
Very sound words of wisdom.
Next week, we'll be talking about the 2019 college admissions bribery scandal that involved Full House star Lori Loughlin and her family, and how this relates to both white privilege as well as rich privilege.
Thank you for listening to us. We hope you stay happy and healthy.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. I'll stop this.